From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like he's in crazy.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, celebrated independent film director Stephen Frears tells why the Hollywood studios aren't for him. Then, the Lennon-McCartney of fake hit songs for music movies. But first, the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by...
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, the TV season is sort of taking shape, and I wouldn't say it's going to be the one that they all want to keep in their photo album this year. It's been a little rough. Pretty much every network has had something that didn't quite work so far, huh?
Well, it sounds as if so far that even though ratings aren't necessarily that bad, the new show ratings are quite bad.
And the older show ratings are definitely tripping up. Yeah, they're slipping.
Fox's Lone Star was pulled after two episodes. ABC yanked My Generation. And then it looks like NBC's Outlaw is definitely on the ropes. They've halted production but haven't quite pulled it off the schedule.
Yeah, it sort of doesn't look so good for Outlaw.
And I think what's also interesting is that none of the new shows, even the popular ones, have cracked the top 10, which my colleague Scott Collins points out has not happened in the last 5 years.
Yeah, and it's hard for NBC in particular because they're in the middle of getting taken over by Comcast, and I'm sure they would have loved to not be stuck in the basement. But so far, the new shows, the event was a big hope for them, and the trajectory is in the wrong direction. So it's just not going to be, I guess the word would be lackluster so far at a difficult time for the broadcast business.
No, and a lot of the shows that had kind of the most publicity coming in the season have not done well. And I would include Elliot Spitzer's CNN show that hasn't not done.
Although in its second outing, it ticked up quite a bit. So maybe people will check it out. Who knows?
Law and Order Los Angeles, not a big hit.
And which is kind of strangely dissociated from actual Los Angeles, if you've checked it out. Meanwhile, chasing ratings, our friends at the Academy, the Motion Picture Academy, are thinking about moving up the Oscars for their telecast, right?
They've been talking about this for a couple of months, and this is not for next year's show, but for the 2012 show. And the real issue is the Oscars right now seem like an afterthought. Everybody else has their shows, and you suffer through weeks and weeks of not just the kind of campaigning and the appearances, but the broadcast film critics, the Golden Globes. Then there's the non-televised awards, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild. And I think the Academy feels like the bloom is well off the rose by the time the Oscars roll around in late February. So they want to move it up to either late January or early February, and it's not going to be that simple.
It's not going to be that simple, partly because of football, am I right?
Football's a huge complication. The NFL is thinking it wants to add two games, and if it adds two games, it may push the playoffs and the Super Bowl around where the Oscars might land. And the other real issue is, how are the Academy members going to see and vote on movies? And they've started looking into streaming movies over the internet, so you would not even have to bother with a DVD, but you'd watch a movie on your laptop, and that seems to defeat the entire purpose of
movies. I can't imagine people would like that who are filmmakers, yeah.
Well, and imagine people at the Academy, and there's certainly people of a certain age and some young people as well who can't figure out how to work a DVD player, so now they're going to be asked to stream movies over the internet, and how do you protect that content? You have movies that are right in theaters over the internet. How is that secure? How do you make sure the balloting is secure, that it can't be hijacked? There are a lot of questions that they have to answer, but the Academy is committed, I think, and they could announce their decision as soon as the NFL makes its decision that they're going to move the show up. And they're never going to be the first show. They'll probably still be last, but it will only be a couple of weeks after the Golden Globes rather than 2 months.
Well, I have to say, with the 10 pictures, the idea of having to watch all the pictures becomes that much more difficult for in the Best Picture category. And I have to eat crow. I thought they were going to dump that after 1 year, but they're still sticking with it. So that'll be a challenge to see all those films. Now, meanwhile, if you're shooting films, Michigan has been a happy home for Hollywood productions because of their tax incentives, but it seems that maybe the good citizens of Michigan won't be so happy to have Hollywood coming to their fair state.
Almost every state in the nation has a tax credit, and Michigan has been one of the most aggressive. It's almost 42% in terms of how much money you spend, you get back in some sort of tax credit. And there's been production after production after production going there. Transformers 3 was there, Youth in Revolt, Gran Torino. And the state finally stopped and took a look at what the results were. And it was, let's say the economics were a little bit like Speed Racer. It was a lot of money out the door and not a lot back. In 2009, they handed out $69 million in tax credits. And they calculated they got $7.5 million back in tax revenue. So,
and I noticed that the Michigan Film Commission surprisingly found this to be unfair, this condemnation. And they were talking about these non-tangible benefits, you know, the excitement of having Hollywood come to Michigan. I don't know what that excitement is worth. But if
there's also there's the spending, like, you know, counting every hotel room, every meal. It's a hard way to calculate that. But this is on the heels of a report that we covered that was out of Iowa that said that system was broken too. So as Hollywood, you know, goes all over the nation looking for these good deals, I think the states are now realizing that these deals are great for Hollywood, but not for the states themselves.
Yes, what a surprise. Hollywood taking advantage of other people's money.
I cannot believe it. Stop the presses.
Shocking. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. At the age of 69, Stephen Frears has made a long list of standout films, including The Grifters, High Fidelity, and The Queen. He's also taken a turn working in the Hollywood studio system with the 1992 Dustin Hoffman movie Hero and the 1996 film Mary Riley with Julia Roberts. Both were disappointments, and as you'll hear from the director himself, Frears has learned the hard way that the independent world is the place for him. His latest film, Tamara Drew, is a comedy of manners based on a popular British graphic novel. It's set in the English countryside, where a group of writers on retreat get drawn into an unexpected drama. It all begins when a young local woman returns from London with a new nose and injects a big shot of sexual energy into a rather sleepy community.
Who's that?
That's Tamara Drew.
No, it isn't.
I met her with Andy.
Good God, what's happened to her?
She had a nose job, Dad.
She's completely different. That's what Andy said.
Poor Tamara. She's such a sad girl. She used to come and help you wash the car, didn't she, Nicholas?
Yeah, when she was a teenager.
She liked a bit of family after her dad left.
Is that Tamara Drew that writes a column in one of the Sundays?
Used to. Writes for The Independent now.
Oh, she spent weeks going on about her nose job. Was her old one an awful conk?
Yes.
She's poured herself into those shorts.
Tamara Drew is the kind of indie film that Frears was born to make. No big budget, no special effects, just a character-driven tale infused with shrewd observations and wit. Imagine that. What is your feel about the U.S. film system? Based on, you've had some couple of very good experiences.
I had good experiences in the independent cinema in America, and I found that I had no capacity. I mean, I was the wrong person for the studio system.
Can you explain that?
I made two studio films, and they were very expensive, much more expensive than anything I'd done. And I found it very, I was just the wrong person. I was standing in the wrong place, really.
Was it because the budgets were unwieldily, you know, the scale was wrong for you?
Well, I mean, I know that if I make a film and all goes well, a certain number of people will see it. But if I make a film that depends on everybody in the world seeing it three times, I can't do that. I just don't do that sort of thing.
And when you were doing those films, what was the experience? Did you know in those moments, like, why am I here?
No, they took a long time. They took 100 days. Now I can make a film in 40 days. So what was I doing on the other 60 days?
I don't know. Were you asking yourself that in the moment?
Well, you just wonder why, when I can work fast. And again, certainly the film with Dustin was a film of wit.
Right.
You know, you just think, why is this taking so long?
Just to remind people who may not remember it or didn't see it, he's a guy who was mistaken for a hero in a plane crash.
That's right.
And then gradually it becomes, the news media actually gets very engaged in forwarding that story. It's really quite current in terms of...
Yes, no. I thought it was a good film. I had no quarrel with the film. It was just the money. I used to say I can deal with the art. It's the money I can't deal with.
You know, that is a kind of self-knowledge that it feels to me that very few directors have.
Right. don't know about other directors. I only know about myself.
But we've seen it again and again where a very promising director becomes bigger and bigger and bigger,
yes.
And the work gets worser and worser.
Yes. You know, nobody was beastly to me. Nobody was, so, you know, there weren't sort of terrible stories, I can tell you. I just found it paralyzing in some way or inhibiting. And I would prefer to make cheaper films.
So did you have a moment where you wisely said to yourself, I'm
yes,
out of
I,
here?
Well, I mean, I had a moment in that I made two films that didn't work, so
right.
I retreated to a more sensible position.
You sort of went from being nominated for an Oscar for Dangerous Liaisons to the Razzie for Mary Reilly.
Yeah, more or less, yes.
So
absolutely.
It
was very, very odd. I made Dangerous Liaisons, then I made The Grifters, and then I signed to do a studio film. And I remember coming for the Oscars for The Grifters, and they said, oh, you should have been at the awards last night. You won the best independent film of the year. By then, I'd signed for a studio, and I said, oh, I see the prize for making the best independent film is that you get to give up your independence. I wasn't that self-aware at the time.
But
I didn't know what the words quite meant at the time, but I discovered that the real division is between studio films and independent films, or it was then. I mean, it means, of course, that I really admire the people who make studio films because they can do what I can't do. And I think it's a very good system, and I don't despise it. I just thought, oh, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I was much more independent than I'd ever realized. I thought I'd be a really good studio director.
Really?
Mm.
And is this a skill set that it's what it comes
it's,
down
it's
to
It's a
that?
Way of seeing the world, I think, and I don't seem to have it. I have a different way of seeing the world.
You paint on a sort of a more intimate canvas, I think.
Maybe, but it is what Robert Altman says. They make shoes and I make gloves. It's really, you know, they're both called films, which is what's confusing.
And yet you see all those shoemakers trying to make gloves and the
yes,
bad
that's
movies.
What I mean.
Yeah.
And that's what you learn. Oh, I see. I can't do that, so I'll
right.
do this.
I mean, I wonder, do you feel secure that this... I mean, you're living on a diminishing island.
Oh, yes. No, I'm quite aware of that.
Do you watch that shoreline all the time?
Yes. Yes, and you just see it shrinking.
And
it's unnerving. And until someone sorts something out on the internet, because there's clearly an audience for intelligent films, grown-up films, but, you know, at the moment, if you go to the cinema, you have a choice between the kind of film I make or Avatar, and... For some reason, people choose Avatar. So it's really as simple as that. Do you want to see this film or do you want to see that film? And, you know, independent films had a good run, but they're very unprotected at the moment.
I wonder, you know, we talked a little bit just before we came on mic here about the illegal downloading and piracy.
Mm.
Does that hurt indie film?
Yes, of course.
Because, you know, people think of it as X-Men was leaked, you know, onto the internet, but
yeah.
And screeners are not available for Pirates of the Caribbean 3, but they are available for something like Tamara Drew. So I'm wondering whether you have any sense of what the impact of that is.
No, but I remember being in Spain with the Queen, and the guy said, you know, there's already been a million copies downloaded, or some ridiculous figure like that.
Right.
Or the revenue, whatever it is. Yes, of course it's damaging.
And as a filmmaker, it must just feel hard.
No, it's just another problem. It's just, you know, well, that revenue is gone. So you can see it makes life harder.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with director Stephen Frears. His new movie, Tamara Drew, is in theaters in New York and L.A. Based on a popular British graphic novel, the film sells itself off that reputation in the U.K. But here in the U.S., Tamara Drew is virtually unknown. So Frears himself is the draw. I asked him how he felt about being the key element in a marketing campaign.
Listen, you know, in the end, you feel responsible for the people with the money. You have to. You can see that they have to be looked after as much as I do. Also, the times are so bad that you're sort of all in the same boat together.
Has it created a sort of despair cup that everybody's drinking from?
I don't have any sense of, you know, the financiers making a fortune on my back. You have to protect them because they've given you the money, so you're bound up together in some
right.
Complicated
way. If you leave them
way.
Holding an expensive bag, then you
yeah.
have sort of harmed one of the few buyers or distributors
Absolutely.
That's still out there.
Absolutely.
Do you worry about box office coming out now with a movie like Tamara Drew?
Yes, of course I do.
I mean, to what degree, though? It's obviously you
well,
don't need to...
I know that if it does well, I'll have an easier life. And if it does badly, it'll be tougher next time. And I wish I was like Woody Allen, who says he doesn't take any interest in that. I mean, who knows if it's true. You know, you try to insulate against it, but of course it's just being realistic.
Now, do the budgets, again, you say that you have to work cheaper.
I can work cheaply. Mm-hmm. So I spent the whole time on a film saying, can't we make this cheaper? Can't we make this cheaper?
It's a dream director.
Why are we spending so much money?
Right. Now, you mentioned Robert Altman, and, you know, he's one of the few that has held on to his relevance and freshness. You know, it did hold on. Do you think that's...
Is that right? Did he?
Well, to me, he did.
Yes.
I wonder...
He was a very inspiring man.
Just in that he kept ticking?
Just by going on and by his sort of, you know, maverick attitude and his high intelligence.
I wonder if he kept his freshness, because so many directors seem to age out in a way, you know. They have this big bang in the beginning, and then the movies get oftentimes more bloated and more horrible. And
are you being polite to me?
No, not at all. You're the exception. I'm trying to get to the compliment.
Yes.
No, so I'm saying that this is something to me that you have in common, especially with a movie like Tamara Drew, which is so, it feels
very, very
so
fresh.
Young. Yes,
absolutely.
And I wonder, is it because that self-knowledge to say, to just say, I'm not going to make myself fit into this system. I'm going to go back and do it what I do.
I don't think you're offered the choice.
Oh, really?
You're more helpless than that. Mm.
So you sort of posited it earlier that you chose not to do it, but maybe you felt like
Well, I chose not to make studio. I mean, they chose as much as I did. I mean, you realize that's a dead end.
It feels like so many directors find the studio money and the whole Hollywood machine to be sort of like the crack pipe. And,
yes.
You know, they keep going back to it even if
yes.
they're getting increasingly
yes.
sick and weak.
Yes,
know?
Well, you try not to be addicted to these things.
Yes, it's important to do that.
But the interesting thing is the business of keeping fresh. I mean, that's, I guess, what I long to do. What I'm saying is that within the world you make films about, you can be fresh or you can be stale.
Right.
I try to be fresh.
I mean, have you ever had a moment where you're working on a movie and thinking, ugh, stale?
No, you think, oh, I shouldn't have done this. Oh, I've made a terrible mistake. You certainly think that.
Wait, right in the middle of the movie?
Yeah.
And then
often you know it beforehand.
Before you even started?
Yes.
That's too late. You're pregnant.
You can't get out of it. Yeah.
Right. Mm. And so then what do you do?
Make the film and don't complain.
Just paddle through.
Do your best. You don't have a choice. And that's what Bob Altman was so good at. He just went on.
Are you beyond having to worry about your next gig?
Well, no, I don't think so. It's really, my problem is always to do with finding material. I mean, when I found Tamara Drew, I was like a child. I was so pleased. So I have to find something that gets me that excited.
And is there a big stack where you're just like,
ugh? No, there's generally one thing around. There's a film in Las Vegas at the moment that's very good, set in Las Vegas, that I like very
much.
That
you're going to do?
Well, that I'll go to the next stage.
Right.
You're both enthusiastic and wary at the same time.
I mean, you have to figure out who it's from and is the money there? Is that what you're wary of? Or are you wary that it's the wrong project artistically?
No, you're wary about spending a lot of money making a film that people don't want to see. It's things like that you worry about.
It ultimately is Vegas.
The problem is the whole thing is like a casino. Oh, let's put all our money on this one.
Right, and then you're...
It requires more nerve than I have.
Yeah, I often think I could never lay down, I mean, like a $200 million bet.
I don't know how people sleep at nights. I admire them.
Stephen Frears is a film director of a wide range of movies, including The Grifters and The Queen. His most recent film is Tamara Drew. Thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Tamara Drew is now playing in New York and L.A. What's your favorite Stephen Frears movie? Tell us on the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. Coming up after a short break, the songwriters behind movie music like this.
If you'll permit me, I'd like to sing a song about the mulatto. Live and let live, even if there's mixed blood, that's my motto. One half voodoo, one half Wisconsin. He'll do your taxes, but he won't stop dancing.
You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. On the DVD of the rock and roll comedy Get Him to the Greek, there's a behind-the-scenes extra about music in the film. And that extra includes an interview with Dan Byrne and Mike Viola. They are two of the singer-songwriters hired by producer Judd Apatow to help create songs for the central character, drug-addled British rocker Aldous Snow, played by Russell Brand.
I have crossed the mystic desert to snap pictures of the poor. I've invited him to brunch, let him crash out on my floor. There's sunshine in my veins, my kitchen's filled with flies. I'm crying out in vain, like a little African child.
Viola and Byrne had an earlier turn as movie music Cyranos. They were among a slew of songwriters hired by Apatow and director Jake Kasdan on the 2007 movie Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, a spoof biopic of a country rock star played by John C. Reilly.
I stand for the midget. I stand for the Negro. I stand for the engine, all hopped up on booze. I stand for the Jap. And I stand for the Beaner. I stand, yes I do, for the Christ-killing Jew.
For Walk Hard, Kasdan needed original songs written in the voice of Dewey Cox, music that was good but also funny. He turned to both Dan Byrne and Mike Viola. At the time, Viola was living in New York and Byrne was in New Mexico. When they met during pre-production on Walk Hard in L.A., they collaborated on what would become the final song, Beautiful Ride, and they went on to contribute numerous other songs to the movie separately and as collaborators. From that experience, they became writing partners, and soon, responding to the siren song of Hollywood, they moved to L.A. Mike Viola and Dan Byrne talked with our producer, Darby Maloney, about working on Walk Hard and Get Him to the Greek.
How were you sort of given a tonal sense for Get Him to the Greek, Dan?
You know, a lot of that was Russell Brand himself. Between who Russell Brand is and who Aldous Snow is, I think it's a much more fluid line than Reilly and Cox. Looking back, maybe I thought that they were one and the same. And maybe they aren't, you know. We kind of went through this thing where, you know, I read his book because it was just out at that time called My Bookie Book. It's
Dan
great.
Dan went deep.
And, you know, there's a lot of VH1 stuff. There's a lot of YouTube. So I kind of channeled him for a few weeks there. And we were writing songs kind of in Russell Brand's voice, and I was all the demos. I was singing like this, you know, English guy.
Like one, two, three.
When you showed up on my doorstep, tried to knock me on me ass.
Like that.
And then, like, all these little vocal stylings, like, hello, and all these things he does. And, like, these are in the songs. And none of those really made it.
We were so sure, like, we were channeling Russell Brand.
Yeah,
we're doing
man, we
it.
Were. There was nobody else. We were so into
phone
scientists.
Didn't ring for 2 weeks. For 2 weeks. We finally called them, like, so, you having trouble catching up to our genius over here? Like, you need some help in the studio? It's like, yeah, the latest batch you guys sent, you know, just kind of straying a little too far.
Sometimes, you know, it's like anything. You're writing something, you have to go too far and then pull it back.
Do you guys have any songs at the ready that didn't make it? Any of those that strayed too far?
Yeah, Oh Not to Be Famous. That was a great song.
Oh Not to Be Famous.
Oh Not to Be Rich. Oh Not to Have All the Magical People to Share My Body With.
That was a good one. It might be a nice thing to talk about Furry Walls. That was a very difficult song to nail. And like Beautiful Ride, they were looking for the big finale. What happened is they had test screenings, and it became apparent that Furry Walls, the scene in the movie, mm-hmm. where they're tripping and they're stroking this furry wall, and that was the funniest scene in the picture, according to these focus groups. So they decided, you know what? Let's just go with a gag song, but point back to that scene to remind people that that's the best part of the movie. So that was a stroke of genius, I think, on Judd's part. So we started writing this song called Furry Walls, being verbose and trying to do all this stuff and make it clever and funny and kind of cool.
And then we got this very short, succinct, beautiful email from Judd saying, this song is about a furry wall.
It goes something like this. Furry walls, blah, blah, blah. Furry walls, blah, blah, blah. Furry walls, furry walls. So he got a co-write on it because, you know, he wrote the first verse.
So in that case, this was shot. Because I was picturing that a lot of the songwriting you do on these movies happens before you see any scenes. Because that's how it worked on Walk Hard, right?
Correct.
Because every song had to be performed.
But actually on Walk Hard, we wrote on the set, remember?
Yeah. You know, there had been these protest songs that Dewey was meant to have been writing.
Right. And Dan, this was in the 60s when he was sort of in his Bob Dylan influence.
Right.
Period.
And, you know,
there was a midget song that they had said, okay, we're going to do this midget song. In the day before they
were going to... he's an advocate for midgets.
He's advocate for midgets, but he's got it all wrong and he's totally insulting them, but he doesn't realize it. And we're just sitting here, kind of like a day off, and Dan and I just on set drinking all the free like coffee and free granola bars, and we get this tap on the shoulder, and John Riley's like, what does he say? I challenge the bards or something like that. And we're like, what? Oh, crap, what? He's like, we rewrite these two songs. That's what happened, right?
Yeah.
And then we went into a room somewhere in the theater and cranked out Let Me Hold You, Little Man. It's like,
all the elevator buttons so incredibly high. I stand today for the midget half the size of a regular guy. So let me hold you, little man. Pretend that you're flying in space. Let me hold you, midget man, so the dog will start licking your face.
And Manish, Manish had one of those great lines in there.
Yeah, Manish actually wrote that line.
Licking your face, yeah.
That's
like
great.
We were writing this song in this room in the theater, and they were painting the protest signs for the scene in another part of the theater. And then the next day they filmed it. It's pretty great.
I kind of keep wanting to call you guys screenwriters because it does feel like an offshoot of the screenplay. If you were to liken yourself to anybody else on the set, would you say, you know, you're most comparable to whoever the screenwriter is?
No, because we're listed last in the credits.
After everyone leaves.
You're below the line.
Below the horses and dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's its own thing. There are definitely times when in writing songs for pictures like these, we have something to do with shaping the characters. We like to believe that anyway.
I'm curious because you guys still are relatively new in the business and yet you've worked on pretty big movies. Like, what's your take on the movie business after coming off of decades in the music business? Mike?
Just so you know, like literally I've been to 2 meetings in 3 years. So I'm not like entrenched in the business side at all. We're both very low key. We get calls directly from producer directors and it's never through an agent, stuff like that. So I don't really have.
You guys don't have agents.
No.
Yeah.
But as compared to the music business that I come from, it's fantastic. When you make a movie, you're part of a big army.
Yeah.
It's like the biggest tour ever imagined, you know?
Cool. Well, Mike Viola. And Dan Byrne, thank you guys for coming in.
Thanks, Darby.
Thanks, Darby.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is the executive producer. The theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. To leave a comment about today's show, email us at thebusiness@kcrw.org or go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. Where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.